Thank you, Bob Kessler. How are you, sir? Good to hear
Doing
your voice.
Great. Thank you. Good to hear yours, John Williams.
Yeah, that's me. I'm here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. I'm on
Even
Saturdays
better.
From 1 to 3. So, you know, Bob, it seems like everybody's talking all the time about the election coming up. Because it feels like the election is tomorrow, doesn't it? I thought maybe we'd take a little break at the start of the show today from that.
I like that idea.
It's sort
Good
of
call,
like, here's
John.
What, here's, well, don't worry. It's irresistible. I'll be getting to it soon, but at least I won't start there. Here's what we do in America. We get up, we have some breakfast, brush our teeth, and then we start talking about Donald Trump. That's what we do now. That's who we are. If you bump into somebody, it's going to come up, unless you know you guys are so completely different on that topic that you know, it's not a good place to go. But pretty much that's what we do. Even when we tell ourselves, okay, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to give him my mind, my soul, my heart, my head today. You start talking about Donald Trump. It's the craziest thing. Our Mincing Rascals segment will break down the unbelievable debate that was this week. We'll let the experts talk about that. That'll come your way here on WGN Radio at 1:30. You know, just as a departure from all of that, and because truly my heart is in this topic as well, last Sunday George Kennedy died. I'm not a big movie buff, and I was not a big George Kennedy fan per se, but maybe you were like me. When you heard that George Kennedy passed away, you immediately started to play back scenes from some of his movies, especially Cool Hand Luke. He was born February 18th, 1925, in New York City. This is his wiki on that, into a show business family. His father, George Harris Kennedy, was a musician and orchestra leader. He died when Kennedy was 4 years old. His mother was a ballet dancer. She raised him. Kennedy, in fact, made his stage debut at the age of 2 in a touring company of Bringing Up Father. And by the age of 7, he was a New York City radio DJ. 7 years old, joining the U.S. military during World War II. He spent 16 years in the service until the late 1950s. He got a back injury. He couldn't be in the service anymore. He had to find new work. His first film, 1960, Spartacus. He made numerous television appearances on shows such as The Asphalt Jungle, The Andy Griffith Show, Peter Gunn. And then came the role for which he won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in Cool Hand Luke in 1967, that of Dragline, a chain gang convict who at first resents the new prisoner in camp played by Paul Newman, and then comes to idolize the rebellious Luke. In 1970, he appeared in the Academy Award-winning disaster film Airport, in which he played one of its main characters, airline troubleshooter Joe Petroni. He reprised this role in Airport 1975, Airport 1977, and The Concorde, Airport 79. The Airport franchise helped inspire the Zucker, Abrahams and Zucker satire Airplane, in which the filmmakers hoped to cast Kennedy as the bumbling plane dispatcher. That role went to Lloyd Bridges because Kennedy said, quote, "I can't kill off the airport cash cow." Yeah, maybe so. In 1984, Kennedy starred opposite Bo Derek in the box office bomb Bolero. He died last Sunday at the age of 91. He was married 4 times, twice to the same woman, Norma Wuerman, but married 4 times and passed away last Sunday. And I was glad to see Michael Phillips the next day write this about him. Phillips wrote, "My first indelible movie image of a terrible Midwestern blizzard has George Kennedy's face on it. On Sunday, the Oscar-winning Kennedy died. According to his grandson's Facebook post, there should be a special place in the afterlife for character actors like Kennedy, a celestial dressing room where all the reliable, familiar, utility men and women who've passed on can enjoy each other's stories about everybody they worked with in the industry. Kennedy won his supporting actor Oscar for Cool Hand Luke in 1967. And that's the one I was thinking about a lot this week. I've been playing back some of those scenes. Have you been doing this too, or were you at least a little bit when he passed away?
When I'm on here, boss.
You see that? You see that?
I got eyes, don't I? I'm not going to see something that look like that.
Man, oh man, look at that. Look at that.
Wiping off there, boss.
Wipe it off, Captain. Taking them off here, boss.
All right, take it off.
Damn things is blocking the scenery.
She ain't got nothing but one safety pin holding that thing on. Come on, safety pin. Pop.
Hey, Lord. Whatever I done, don't strike me blind for another couple of minutes.
Well, there they are. You know, tarring the road or digging a ditch, the chain gang, and there's the pretty gal washing the car. They cannot take their eyes off of her. Then there was another great scene in that movie. This is the one where Paul Newman's character gets the nickname of Cool Hand Luke. Kennedy and Newman's characters had had a fight in the prison yard, and Kennedy just about killed Newman's Cool Hand Luke character. That night, they're all sitting there in the barracks, and they're playing poker. And Kennedy starts to give advice to one of the other guys playing against Newman.
The man's got kings, get your tail out. You want to see him?
Yeah.
Right there. One, two, three, four, five.
Yeah. Oh. Piped up, right?
Another. And he beat you at nothing. Just like today when he kept coming back at me with nothing.
Yeah, well... Sometimes nothing can be a real cool hand.
Move over. Move, sit in here next to my boy. Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke. And then they become best buddies. And then, bored one night, Newman's character says he can eat 50 eggs.
I can eat 50 eggs.
Nobody can eat 50 eggs.
You just said he could eat anything.
You ever eat 50 eggs?
Nobody ever eat 50 eggs.
Hey, Babalugat, we got a bet here.
My boss says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
One rule. No throwing up. He throws up, you forfeit everything.
Now, when was the last time you ever saw my boy throw up? Now, shut your mouth and give your money to Coco.
Look, what you have to say 50? Why couldn't you say 35 or 39?
That seemed a nice round number.
Luke, that's money you're talking about. What's the matter with you?
Yeah, well, it'd be something to do.
They were good in that movie, weren't they?
The winner is George Kennedy in Cool Hand Luke.
Oh, I could bust. I have to thank Stuart Rosenberg for giving me the opportunity to even be here. And I must simply thank the Academy for the greatest moment of my life. Thank you.
That was it. That was the entirety of his speech. He was really a humble guy. And you knew if Kennedy wins for Cool Hand Luke, then Paul Newman is a cinch, right?
Warren Beatty in Bonnie and Clyde, Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke, Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, Spencer Tracy in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night. May I have the envelope? Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night. Warren.
So, no, he did not win, did he? Man, what a lineup. That's a tough year for best actor, isn't it?
I'm wondering, is Rod Steiger, he's not still alive, is he?
I don't think so.
I have to Google that.
You know, it's almost beside the point. If people have to Google you to see if you're still alive, you're kind of still not alive.
He's not. Since 2000, he died in 2002.
Yeah, we miss him.
Yeah. The Oscars were a lot different back then. There wasn't quite,
oh my gosh. Yeah,
it wasn't quite the thing. I saw.
It was so dignified. I mean, like, literally, they'll say things, and if I may just say so, like, the attitude is completely different now. For instance, this year's Oscars were a little bit different than that now, weren't they?
A little bit different.
So then you start thinking about George Kennedy, and you start thinking about the Naked Gun 2.5.
You got an address in there?
What I've got is a card that says Monique DiCarlo, 210 Bleckman Street. That's the red light district. Wonder why Savage is hanging out down there.
Sex, Frank?
No, not right now, Ed. We got work to do.
And if you start to think about that, then you start to think about the movie Airplane, which he said, no, I can't be in that.
Joey, you ever hang around the gymnasium? You like movies about gladiators?
All right, we'll leave it there. So, farewell, George Kennedy. That was fun. So, 119, this is WGN. I'm John Williams. You know, Eric Zorn mentioned on this show a couple of Saturdays ago that one of the most interesting and popular podcasts right now is something called Sleep With Me. Sleep With Me. It's not what you think it is. I want you to hear an excerpt from this fascinating podcast, and then part of a conversation I had with him this week. That's coming up next here on WGN. So this next segment, it'll be very brief. We'll pause. Bob will update you on the news here in a couple of minutes. And then our Mincing Rascals, we're a round table of really smart people, excluding me. We'll talk politics. They'll break down this amazing debate this past week. But this little brief segment here goes out to a couple of friends of mine, Polly and Karen, and you too, if you really have trouble going to sleep. Eric Zorn said to us a couple of weeks ago that one of the most popular podcasts on iTunes right now, one of the most popular podcasts in the world, is called Sleep With Me. And it's a guy whose purpose is, you put your buds in while you're laying there, his talking will put you to sleep. That's it. Here's 10, 15, 20 seconds of his recent podcast.
Probably also built at a high cost to the people. I didn't even think about the socioeconomic impacts until just this second. But just like the nuclear weapons, it was a deterrent in Montezuma's, presumably, this is my interpretation. And they say, well, didn't you write this story? No, I interpreted this story from, story swamp in my brain. The old story swamp, that's where this stuff, you say, how'd you come up with a scooter? They'd say, it's a story, I got a swamp of stories in my brain. I just go in there, pull out some muck, smash it to, kind of like making a mud pie. I got distracted.
And he goes on like that.
That is word salad.
Isn't that, it is. It's stream of consciousness. In fact, he'll say as much. It reminds me of Ken Nordine or somebody like that, who they'll seize a word, although Nordine was different, but I mean.
Word jazz.
It was. But, he'll say something, and then he'll seize that word, and then he'll talk about pies. But then pies remind him of cake. But then that'll remind him of some historical figure, and he'll just kind of wander around. And I can imagine, especially with that hypnotic delivery of his, that there's nothing real consequential about the words or the stories he's telling. And so you don't get too wrapped up in it, and it almost hypnotizes you. So that's good. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. But the podcast is called Sleep With Me. And the guy works at a library in San Francisco. He's been doing it for a couple of years. His name is Drew Ackerman. I called Drew this week. And I said, Drew. And by the way, I was really hoping that he didn't sound like that in his normal conversation. I said, what makes you so successful?
I think it's a combination of natural boringness and embracing that and a little bit of having the courage to see what that means and kind of see if it can be crafted at all.
Well, clearly it's an affect, because I can already tell you're an interesting, engaging person. And if you didn't cut through the clutter on iTunes, welcome to the world. When did the light bulb go off then? When did you realize if I just turn it down a little bit, I might have something here?
It took a little while. It took practice in putting the show out and kind of getting feedback to kind of get the rhythm right. But the light bulb actually went off the first time I heard the Dr. Demento show when I was in my bedroom and I couldn't sleep as a kid. That's when I was like having something to kind of turn to in the middle of the night that was fun and lighthearted. That kind of changed it for me, and it planted the seed that would eventually become the podcast.
But did Dr. Demento put you to sleep or keep you awake and entertain you?
It kept me awake, but it was like when I was in grammar school and I had this like childhood insomnia and I was terrified about going to school the next day. And it gave me like a safe place where I wasn't worried about school or I wasn't thinking about it. So it was one part of the podcast that I think works, is just kind of distracting people from all the rigmarole that's keeping them awake.
Still, did you try a podcast that was, hey, I'm Drew and we're doing current events here, or I'm telling wacky stories? Did you try a more traditional entertaining podcast?
No, but I did go down that road. Like, I read a lot of stuff about energy and enthusiasm, and a lot of people were like, well, even, you should be enthusiastic at the beginning of your show. So when I first started doing it, my openings would be really enthusiastic, I think because I was nervous and I was trying to find my voice. And eventually I realized, oh, no, I don't. If I'd be more authentic and just kind of slow down a little bit and kind of be myself, but on a kind of slower, more relaxed way, that's what ended up working.
But was the purpose even at the outset to help people go to sleep?
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't like a guaranteed thing. It was something I was like, oh, would this work? And I didn't really have an audience or anybody to worry about, like, meeting their expectations. It was kind of like, huh, could I tell, like, little bedtime stories for grown-ups that will help them fall asleep, or will it not work?
Right.
And then once it worked for a few people, I said, oh, well, what else could I do to be lulling and soothing and make people feel comfortable and at ease and distracted and kind of forget about what's keeping them awake?
Well, did there come a point, though, where the content wasn't so important as the delivery itself?
I think they go hand in hand. It's like the delivery and the pacing and that kind of stuff's important, but I think the content, even though most people never hear it, and maybe this is just the delusional side of me, is I think it has to be a complete episode every time for some there's some message that comes across to people that, okay, I don't have to listen to this because it's complete, as opposed to like white noise or rainforest sounds. For some people, that doesn't work because they know it's going to be the same and they know it's repeating. And so then that agitated part of them says, hey, give me your attention. Don't go to sleep. Let's do some to-do lists. So I want to just keep people, it's almost like I'm entertaining, instead of a person, I'm entertaining these more distracted, high-intensity parts of your brain, or your anxieties, or whatever you want to call it.
No, I get that. It makes sense the way you put it. That is brilliant to think about that. Drew Ackerman is on a line. He's the host of Sleep With Me, the podcast. How many people download your podcast, Drew?
You know, I don't have exact numbers, but it's a lot of people, and it's always impressive to me that, like that anybody would listen and that anybody would trust me. Like, it's always, I feel like I credit my listeners with this huge leap of faith. They're going to put earbuds in,
yeah,
and trust this strange man to kind of carry them off. So I really take that seriously.
How many new podcasts do you do each week?
3 a week. So it's, I mean, as you know, like when you're, the train's always moving, so you got to keep up with it. So it keeps me on my toes for sure, but I think having the variety and knowing that there's going to be 3 episodes is part of kind of what works.
And how long does each podcast go?
It goes about an hour. I find, again, it's like that hour gives people plenty of time to kind of let go of the expectation that they should fall asleep or they have to, and that they can just kind of listen passively and then kind of fall, you know, at any point in the podcast, they can just fall right out and drift off into dreamland is the ideal goal.
That's his niche, Drew Ackerman, and that podcast is called Sleep With Me, and it every episode has this
cost
same...
to the people. I didn't even think about the socioeconomic impacts till just a second, but...
Sounds like that. Good for him. The news is next on WGN. All right, thank you, Bob Kessler. So they had this big debate this past weekend, this past week. What was it? This is Saturday. When was the
Thursday?
Debate, Bob? Was it Thursday night? Maybe it was Wednesday night.
I just watched whatever night before I watched the highlights. That's whatever night it was.
Well, that was, there was a lot of highlights. So, well, it was Thursday night, now that I think about it, because the next day, the Mincing Rascals, that's this little round table of smart people, and I sat down and talked a little bit about it. And on Saturday afternoons here on WGN, we do a Mincing Rascals segment where we play back part of that podcast. You can hear the whole podcast, but here's at least an excerpted highlight from the gang. The gang includes, well, we start with Steve Bertrand.
Hello, John Williams.
Also, Kristen McQuarrie joins us, editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Kristen.
Hey,
how are
John.
You?
Good.
Eric Zorn joins us normally, but he can't today because he's at the Big True False Film Festival in Missouri, which is awesome. Mark Baser is sitting in for him, a friend of ours, a sometimes columnist, comedian, and follower of the news. Hi, Mark Baser. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I don't know how to introduce you. I don't know what are you, Mark Baser? What are your best credentials for this podcast?
Follower of the news. That sounds fine. The interview show, talk show host.
Once a month, he does a stand-up interview talk show. It's comedy. It's current events. It's brilliant. We'll talk more about that another day.
You've ever been on that, Kristen? I've never been on that.
No.
I think John's been on that, which might be why he says
it's
brilliant.
That's why I get the plug, yeah.
Right.
By the way, Steve, whenever you talk too long, we'll just hit that little sound.
And then you talk for 45 more seconds.
Sorry. What did you say?
Nothing.
That was the buzzer they used in the debate. It'll be remembered as the one where Donald Trump said his is big enough. Thank you very much. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Okay, that concludes today's podcast. Yeah.
Is that one of the things? Goodness. Is that one of the things that they fact check afterwards?
We'd like to see pull it a fact.
Yeah.
Well, if you here's the third best 30 seconds of that.
I have to say this. He hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee it.
Okay. It just shows Mitt Romney had an instant impact on the race.
Well, it was an interesting strategy for the Republicans because the day before they marched him out, he gave an eloquent, kind of funny, but searing, you know, critique of the Trump phenomenon. Yeah. What did I say?
No, I'm just saying you said him, but it was Romney.
So there was Romney, you know, kind of carrying the water for the Republican Party. That's going to do one of two things. It's either going to backfire. It'll only, you know, solidify the resolve of the Trump supporters. Or maybe it's going to cause some people to go, yeah, this is the sensible adult in the room.
It was a strong speech, you know. I mean, he has such credibility. His ethics are, you know, untouchable for most Republicans, I think. And so for him to just kind of put together all the different things that Donald Trump has done, this is one of the lines from Mitt Romney's speech. This is an individual who mocked a disabled reporter, who attributed a reporter's questions to her menstrual cycle, who mocked a brilliant rival who happened to be a woman due to her appearance, who bragged about his marital affairs, and who laces his public speeches with vulgarity. And I mean, those are like the strongest words I've ever heard Mitt Romney say. He was so timid when he ran, but it was pretty searing.
And then Trump's rebuttal to that.
Yeah, Romney had asked for Trump's endorsement, I guess.
He said he would have dropped to his knees if I asked him.
And had paraded him around a little bit in 2012.
What was the meaning of that, get on his knees, by the way? I mean, I think that means get on his knees and pray, right?
Well, or beg.
Beg, yeah.
But that wasn't my first thought.
And no.
There's
still
a sexual innuendo.
Right, we're still on
there.
The penis theme.
Isn't that stunning? Isn't that stunningly vulgar? Holy cow.
No.
You didn't think that at all?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm no fan of Trump's, but I think in that case he just clearly meant.
Oh, you don't think that's not a double entendre on his part, Mark?
I don't think so.
I think it was quite calculated.
See, Mark, I don't know if he did either, but it was the first thing I thought of.
Well, that's just that goes to show either your brain or Trump's brain. I don't know. One thing that I thought Romney came off very well. The speech, I watched the whole thing. He made the point just as well as John Oliver had on the left side on the show that he devoted entirely to Trump. But one thing that I wondered about was that for all the things that you just said, Kristen, is that Romney did accept Trump's endorsement back in 2012, and all of those things that you just cited and that Romney cited hadn't happened yet then. But at the time, Trump was a full-on birther about Obama. There were clearly things that were wrong about Trump dating back that far.
But
so it erases the credibility to a large degree of what Romney said, because he went along with it before.
Well, you can accept someone's endorsement without saying you think that person is qualified to be president himself.
True.
Right?
But would you, it does, I think, have some relevance as to what the people who endorse you believe in.
Well, I think it was a very tactical thing when Romney did it, because remember, Trump was making noise then, was inviting people in to meet with him as if he was going to be a kingmaker, and he was sort of, you know, uncontained at that time. So by getting his endorsement, then they brought Trump on his side, you know, sort of a protective measure. And even if you look at Romney's words when he took the endorsement, he said, you know, this is one of those things where I never thought I'd be here. you know, double entendre there, or I don't know. But I think they took the endorsement out of necessity just to keep him from attacking Romney. And I just think, I don't know, it's not a fair equation to say that because you accept someone's endorsement that you think that someone is qualified to be president.
No, I agree with that. But my only point is that if there were somebody that were making as insane an allegation as the fact that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States and other things that Trump had done prior to that as well, that would not be somebody that I wanted in my court if I were running for president. I'm not saying that Romney ever said
no,
that
I'm
Trump,
with you. I think they brought him in to shut him up.
That might be
well, right. And also helps that he was super duper rich too, right? I mean,
right.
maybe there was something to that.
Needed a check written, correct.
I am sure, to your point, that he did not like Trump at the time.
Yeah. Well, but that's kind of the David Duke problem in a way, isn't it, though? I mean, if somebody says they support you and you don't support them, you just kind of want to ignore it because one of the collateral advantages of that is that some people like David Duke. And if you can get them in your tent without having to open it for them, then that doesn't really hurt you. You just kind of look the other way. I think that's what Trump tried to do when David Duke spoke out positively about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think he was trying to not discourage any voter at all. And so he didn't want to disdain. I don't ever want to hear the word disavow again, though. I've heard it way too many times.
Right.
But right, so he thought, well, if I just don't say anything, then I won't turn off any of these possible voters.
And yeah, but really, what it a just bad shows calculation.
What a, well, it shows what a political novice he is.
Right, because there aren't that many people that support David Duke. I mean, the better play would have been to really pounce on that and say, no, no, no. And then anybody who is wondering about Trump would say, ah, see, he's a good guy. He has my values, too. He's not a white supremacist. So maybe that was the bad play for him.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there came a point in the debate last night where he said, and I haven't even started on Hillary yet, you wait until, because they were comparing his numbers to hers in a straight-up race. And he was like, well, that's because I haven't begun to work on her. And I thought, oh, God, I don't have the stomach for that. I just can't imagine what he would be saying about her and Bill. And it would be so dispiriting to kind of endure that through November, you know what I mean?
I mean, we actually watched a presidential debate where they talked about penis size. I mean, how much worse can it get?
When was the last time that happened? Like when Fillmore ran, right? Back then.
I don't know that it did. Well, actually, we did talk about it when Hillary's husband was president.
Not
but that,
that was way,
for an entirely
but it was,
different
yeah.
reason.
It really looked like they were going to come to blows at one point.
Yeah,
the whole little
really
Marco,
did.
Lion, Ruben, or whatever, Rubio, or little Marco, Lion, Ted, or whatever it was. Yeah,
Lion Ted over
I mean,
here.
I
started
think,
to.
I thought they might come, and then I also wondered if Kasich would just walk off, you know, whether that would serve him. But I guess it wouldn't. Wouldn't have
I
done
think
well.
Kasich played it pretty well. You know, he didn't try and insert himself. I think the winners last night were Cruz and Kasich because twice, in two separate occasions, Cruz said, this is just a 10-second soundbite, guys, but Cruz said something like this.
Senator Cruz.
Brett, you know, I think the American people understand that yelling and cursing at people doesn't make you a tough guy. We need a commander-in-chief.
You know, he was positioning himself as the guy who was a little bit above the fray. All evidence to the contrary. And then Kasich particularly didn't get into it. After
I can't
the debate,
stand him. I cannot.
Kasich?
Stand. Yeah, I
Kasich?
Can't. I'll tell you why. I'll
you mean
tell
the
you
qualified
why.
One?
Maybe because my
happy warrior.
Maybe
he's a happy warrior.
Maybe
how could you be against that?
Maybe because my parents live in Ohio and they don't have fond things to say. But you know, he had that moment in the debate. First of all, you're right. Happy warrior. He's acting like he's so above the fray. And he has that line where he's talking about gay marriage. And whether somebody could sell, who didn't believe
wedding
in gay marriage.
Cakes,
right, don't take
like
I think they used cupcakes, which somebody on Twitter put, who has cupcakes at a wedding?
Ohio.
Whatever. Whatever.
Anyways, he says, I wish it just didn't get to the legal system. I wish we could all just get along and love each other. And if you don't agree with it, then don't sell them a cupcake. Don't sell them a cake. And let that be okay to the gay couple. Don't worry about it. And so on the one hand, he's saying, let's all go above the fray and love each other. On the other hand, he's endorsing what I would call discrimination. So he's acting like something that he's acting as if he's above the fray and all about love and everything. But that was exactly the opposite of what the actual message
was.
See, it's
funny. I think I kind of like what he says there. It's like, you know what? You should sell them a cupcake. But if you don't want to, and if they don't want to sell you cupcakes, go. There are plenty of people who do. Go find someone. Now,
who's the federal government?
Mark's
to
giving
tell
me
you?
A look.
I am.
Yeah, no
I know.
Kidding.
And I agree with you with the law 110%. Absolutely. They should be obligated to. And if required, they should be forced to. But I think what he's saying is that if you're the offended party, don't do with those losers. Go somewhere else and give someone else your business rather than taking it to court all the time. I think that's not – I think I kind of – I'm okay with that.
I mean, the equivalent would be – and you could say I'm making a false equivalent, but I'm not – I don't think I am – which is back in the days when yeah. some people refused service to black people, you could say, hey, don't worry about that diner. Go to the diner down the street because they'll serve black people.
Yeah.
So
you know,
Kasich.
You're right.
25. He has 25 delegates. Trump has 329.
Good point.
I mean, I don't really think.
But they haven't voted in Ohio yet, Kristen.
I know.
And they have 9,000 delegates. Every citizen of Ohio is a delegate.
Yeah, well, maybe that would save them. So that's part of our Mincing Rascals podcast. It goes about 30, 40 minutes this week, and you can hear it at WGNplus.com. You can also subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast at the iTunes store. This is John Williams. Thanks to Mark Baser for filling in. He's funny. And, of course, Kristen McQuarrie and our very own Steve Bertrand. It's 151. This is WGN. You heard something there you want to comment on. We'll give you a chance to chime in next on GN Radio. It's 155 now on WGN. Bob will do the news here for you in a few minutes. And then afterwards, I'll talk to a guy named Kevin Hazard. Kevin has written a book called 1,000 Naked Strangers. The subtitle is A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. He was a guy who had a bunch of classmates who, after 9/11, went off to the war and did grand and dangerous and important things, and he wasn't feeling it, and then found himself signing up for an EMT class and thought maybe this is a way to make some sort of contribution. And what he learned and what he saw and how he changed is fantastic. I mean, not necessarily all good. In fact, there was a point in the story where he starts to realize that maybe this won't be the career he'll have his whole life. I'll let him explain. I mean, maybe he'll tell us that, no, this is ultimately his work. But there comes a point where at least he realizes he's changing. He'd been out in the field for a while, for a couple of years. At one point, he came home one day after work, and there was something stuck in his boot tread, and he thought it was a piece of glass or a stone. You know how you get something in your shoe, and it's scratching their hardwood floor. And so he sits down, takes off his boot, and digs it out, and realizes that it's some skull bone. It's somebody's head bone stuck inside his tread. He had been at a terrible accident. A car hit some people and wiped them out. It was awful. And as he was cleaning up, he got some of the bone in his tread. So he gouged it out with something and then held it up to his wife and said, ah, look at this. This is somebody's skull. And she looked at him and she said, who are you? What's happening? And he went, oh, yeah, right. You know, like the dark humor at the office maybe works as a coping mechanism, but now he was bringing it home. A really interesting little passage in the story there, but it's a longer story than that. The book is called 1,000 Naked Strangers. The anecdotes are amazing, and the overview is good, too. The author is Kevin Hazard. He'll join us after the news. The news is next here on WGN. Listen, Bob, I know this is going to sound like a first-world problem to you. Hi, this is John Williams on WGN Radio. Thank you for the news, Bob Kessler. Here's my complaint about my life today. Can I just give that to you, and then maybe I'll be better?
It helps you, yeah. Get it off your chest.
Well, all week long I wait for the Butler basketball game. All week long I wait for the Butler basketball game. There was one this week. I enjoy the midweek game, and then the Saturday game is a big part of my life. So the game started at 1:30. So during the 1:30 news, I just dialed over to make sure it was on. I can tape it at home. This is a beautiful thing. And where I live, they're not showing the game on the advertised channel. They said it was going to be on a channel that, in fact, now there's some other programming. So now I'm not going to be able to watch the game. I can't tell you how that screws up my week and weekend, Bob. I mentioned this to my producer, Griffin, and he said, well, what you should do is call your cable provider and scream at someone with no power or authority to do anything about that.
Or mention it on the radio.
Yeah,
either
I know.
One
I know.
Is probably yeah. Therapeutic for you.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what Twitter's for, too. You know, come up with some clever hashtag like, you guys are terrible. So, or something like that, and then just launch it out there into the Twitterverse. That'll teach them. That'll teach them, by golly. So let's go to this book, 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin Hazard wrote it. I read it. Wow, what a ride it is. Kevin, welcome to the show. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
What made you decide to become it? You're a paramedic in the book, but you started out as an EMT, right?
Yeah, EMT is sort of the understudy of a paramedic.
Really? So the paramedic has more skills. You actually had to take another 9 months of classes and sort of intern in order to become a paramedic, right?
Yeah, the designation is almost like, imagine you're an EMT is the nurse and a paramedic is the doctor. paramedic is the one that's ultimately in charge of all the more advanced medical decisions.
You were doing this in Atlanta. What was the year that you started?
I went to school in 2003, and so by the time I finished, it was the very beginning of 2004.
What made you decide that? I mean, had you always been interested in medicine or emergency services? Why this field?
No, not at all. You know, a lot of people kind of do something similar to me, in which they find themselves in the job one day and realize, wow, this is, you know, this is the greatest thing I've ever done. I'm never going to leave. But my only experience with emergencies before having gone to school was I was leading jet ski tours when I was in college, and two of the guys in my tours crashed, and one of them was badly injured. And I did the only thing that bystanders are asked not to do in an emergency, and I panicked. And so that was always in the back of my mind, that I had once been in a situation where I could help, and I was unable to do so. And then years later, I was working as a reporter, and 9/11 happened. And because I had gone to the Citadel, a lot of my friends were in the military. And, you know, I'm watching them march off to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I realized that they were part of something much larger than themselves. And it just brought me back to the realization that I wasn't really doing what I wanted to be doing, and that, you know, I really wished that I could be doing something greater. And when I came across EMS for a story that I had to write, it clicked instantly. And I remembered that accident back in 97 and the desire to prove myself and to realize that this was a way that I could do something, you know, do something important. And I just quit my job one day and went to school.
Hmm. A lot of us don't know if we have the stomach for it. I mean, is there something beyond an aptitude? There's something constitutionally about you, right, that is either going to let you be or let you not be a good EMT, right?
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting question because, you know, obviously, by all indications, I was not someone who could have made it. And yet...
Yeah, you're the one that panicked.
Yeah, right. 10 years later, you know, I'm winding up a long paramedic career at one of the busiest EMS systems in the country. So it is tough to say what allows it. I think it's a mindset, and you have to, you know, you have to enjoy those crazy moments because so much of the job, you know, it's essentially like you're arm wrestling three people at once. You never have enough hands for everything that's going on. And, you know, can you find a way to slow it down and turn this sort of mangled mess into a one bite at a time meal?
Yeah. But see, that's, I think when you look at the mangled mess, when we're driving down the road and we see a crash, or if something happens someplace and we know somebody's in pain or they're injured or there's blood or there's bones, I think a lot of us turn our heads away and we cannot imagine that we would be the one that would, in fact, say, no, I'm not going to stick my nose in that. I'm going to touch it. I'm going to fix it. It's awful. And this person's in pain and I'm going to experience that with them. Not the same way, but you're going to be in that moment. And I could see the adrenaline attached to that, but I also don't think I'd have the stomach for that. I don't know that I could do that. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, and I certainly felt that way going into it. You know, I wondered, especially not so much as an EMT because, you know, somebody else is in charge. But when I upgraded to paramedic and was on my own and these decisions were going to come down to me, it was a very tense period as I was waiting for my first bad call. Because now all the decisions are made by me, and all the things that have to be done will be done by me. And it's one thing to be there and to watch it, but it's another thing to be able to remain calm and know what you're doing and actually be able to carry out those treatments unassisted on a really critical patient. And so in the run-up to that first bad call as a paramedic when I would be in charge of everything, I was very anxious. And a lot of people are, because there's no way to know until you do it whether or not you can do it. And mine came in the form of a woman who shot 5 times at close range. I mean, she was in very bad, you know, in a very bad way when I got to her. And as soon as I got out and stepped out of the ambulance, I remember hearing she had these gurgling respirations. And so I knew right away that, you know, she was in, you know, really bad situation. And
that means blood in her lungs, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she'd been shot twice in the chest and I think 3 times in the head. And that she was still alive and had a chance was certainly not something that I was expecting. And then when I heard her breathing, I realized, oh, wow, this is a woman who's on the very edge. And I have an opportunity, if I don't screw this up, to help her out. And at that moment where you wonder, okay, am I going to be able to do it? It was almost as if that all that training and coaching and sort of trying to, you know, whispering in my
We're talking with Kevin Hazard. His book is 1,000 Naked Strangers. We cut away a little unexpectedly there, Kevin. That's why you should be an EMT and I should be a talk show host. I just lost the patient.
Yeah, well, don't worry. It didn't bother me at all. I'm used to things not going the way they're supposed to.
Well, let's finish that story, though. So there you were, woman shot 6 times. You don't know if she'll live. She's got raspy sound in her lungs, and you are in the moment there. So how does that story end?
Yeah, so I step out of the ambulance, and as I'm walking up, I hear somebody talking, and I realize somewhere through the conversation that it's me. And it's almost as if I'm not even involved anymore. I feel my hands are moving, my legs are moving. I'm kneeling next to this woman and begin treating her. And it wasn't until I heard the buzz of of our suction unit that I kind of snapped back into the moment and just finished the call. And we got her into the ambulance, transported her. Because she'd been shot in the head, she was having a lot of seizures, and I had to give her a lot of medications, and sort of a rapidly changing situation. We got to the hospital. She was very quickly carted off to surgery, and then it was over, and I was standing outside with my partner, and the ambulance is full of blood, and our stuff is everywhere, and he just, you know, he nonchalantly nodded and said, hey, good job, and he was so nonchalant as if he didn't realize how big that moment was for me. It was kind of the first indicator that, oh, I did a good job. I did not let on how nervous I was in the run-up. And you realize that things just take over, and you get in that moment, and all that training, it works, and you just start doing your job.
Well, a good job for an EMT then, or a paramedic, is, I presume, to get the person alive to the hospital. Is that what a quote-unquote good job is? So if they die at the hospital eventually, that's out of your hands. You at least delivered the opportunity for that person to live to the emergency room physicians. Is that it?
Yeah. You know, when you save someone, you can't take too much credit for it. And conversely, when someone dies on you, you can't take too much blame. You know, all you can do, and it sounds somewhat cliche, but to do the job as well as you can. And occasionally mistakes are made. And those are the things that you always look back on, those moments where you didn't get to someone quick enough, or you didn't realize what was happening fast enough, and the call went south. And so your goal is to just deliver a viable patient to the hospital.
Yeah.
And it's not always going to go well. But you
and one of your colleagues, you had many. I mean, the washout rate is very, very high, as you describe it. But you and one of your colleagues would talk about what the perfect call was. When they make the movie about this, by the way, have the rights to this been optioned? Is anybody making this into a movie?
They have not been optioned, but we've had a lot of inquiries.
Oh, yeah, I can just imagine. And, you know, you don't want to turn it into an old episode of Emergency or Adam 12 or something. I don't know. At times when I was thinking about this as a movie, I thought, well, how will, you know, what's the hook? We've got a million movies and TV shows about doctors and emergency rooms, so I'll let you and them figure that out. But I sure think there's something there. And I thought maybe the title of the movie should be The Perfect Call. Maybe not, but talk about what that was or what that meant to you guys.
Yeah, and it gets back to what you were just saying a second ago about the goal really being to deliver a viable patient to the hospital. That's really what it came down to. Is to us, the perfect call was a call in which all of our skills were going to be put to the test. That, you know, you aren't wishing ill on anyone, but you understand that it's going to happen. And you didn't go through all that training to not be there when it does happen. So you want to be the one who gets called out at somebody's worst moment because you feel that you are the best option for them. And so, to us, the perfect call was someone who was in dire need, whose situation was going to test all of our skills and all of our resources, and we had to be able to do it on our own, and we had to be able to do it well. And the thing that we always debated on back and forth was, well, what happens if the patient doesn't live? Is it no longer the perfect call? And, you know, ultimately we decided, you know, and this is sort of, you know, just conversation to pass the time, but ultimately we decided that the patient didn't. And that gets back to the fact that any time that I, quote-unquote, save somebody, I never felt as if I had saved them. I was simply a part of that chain, and I took pride in the fact that I did my job well, less so than the fact that I was able to save them.
But there was a scene, and it was rather chaotic. I don't remember all of the details now, but you ended up putting 3 people in your ambulance at the same time, right?
Yeah, I believe it was a shooting right after a high school dance. And yeah. 3 kids were shot, and it was kind of there was nobody else around, and it was a busy Friday night, and we had to take all 3 of them.
Is that the one, though, that you thought maybe this is the perfect call, but then you realized when you got one of those kids to the hospital that he'd been shot in the lower back or abdomen, that his kidney had been lacerated, something like that, right?
Yeah, he was the quietest of the three, and one of them had been shot in the face. And he kind of, you know, for obvious reasons, attracted most of our attention. But the quieter of the three had been shot in the lower back, kind of right where your kidney would be. And that we didn't notice it before we got to the hospital really was a, you know, a kick in the gut for us, because, you know, we prided ourselves on being very thorough and being good at our jobs, and to have missed
something like that. How do you not know? How does the kid not say, hey, I've been shot in the back? I can't imagine that. If I cut myself in the kitchen, three houses know about it. How does that happen?
Well, I think he was probably in an early stage of shock. And again, yeah, because there was nobody else around, we agreed to take all three of these kids just so we could get them to surgery as quickly as possible. Had he been with just a single crew, they probably would have taken his shirt off and realized it. But, you know, there was no other help, so we just scooped all three up and went.
Using all of your resources,
Yeah.
Let's pause here for a minute. I want to come back and just ask you a few more questions about your book. It's called A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Well, you have stories like this, Kevin Hazard. A lot of times they aren't stories like this, too. They aren't always the high-speed things. They're going to a nursing home and getting somebody to dialysis. Talk to me a little bit about what that part of your life is like and what happens at the end of this book in a minute here on WGN. Kevin Hazard's book is A Thousand Naked Strangers. Hazard isn't your real name, right? If you're writing a book as an EMT, the best last name to have is Hazard. You just made that up, right, Kevin?
No, that is my real name. People used to look at my badge all the time sitting on a stretcher, and they'd say, oh, you got to be kidding me.
Hazard. You know, though, one of the disheartening things to me was not these heart-racing moments where you're trying to save a life and so forth. It was, you know, you going to a sad house or some nursing home and picking somebody in sometimes deplorable conditions.
Yeah, you know, that's really the bulk of the job is, you know, the elderly are the ones who need the most help. And they are the seemingly the quote-unquote boring calls, you know, the most quotidian. And you need to have the same approach. You need to be as engaged with those calls as you are in any other, because oftentimes those are the people who really need you the most. You know, there are people who would call simply because they were bored. You know, their husband is dead, their kids live out of town, they have no more friends, and they would want someone to sit there for 30 minutes and hold their hand and talk. And that's a big part of the job, because it isn't, you know, it isn't a hospital. You are being called out to somebody's house. It's a very intimate, very personal relationship that develops. And then the course of that hour, it's a different type of job than I think a lot of people realize.
Well, did you get sad? Because you go into these houses and sometimes they're not clean or well kept, and the quality of life for people sitting there in the bed that's now been put in the living room is not a good quality of life. How did you feel about all of that?
Those are heart-wrenching. And, you know, some of the worst are you see some young people that have been injured in a car wreck, or, you know, they've been shot and they're now bedbound. And one of the first ones that I encountered was a young girl, really angry. And I turned to my partner at one point and I said, man, this girl, she's driving me nuts. And he said, well, how would you feel if you'd been in a wheelchair since you were 17? And that was an eye-opening moment. It's so easy to not see things from somebody else's perspective. But yeah, it breaks your heart to see somebody like that, because only imagine what it must be like.
Who are the people that are drawn to this? What are EMTs like? Give me some generalities, or paramedics for that matter.
Well, there's a certain, there's kind of a class of adrenaline chasers, which they tend to wash out fairly quickly because they find that not enough of the job brings adrenaline. There are people who aren't sure what to do with their lives, and they come across this job which, you know, with a high school education and a lack of felonies, they can get a respectable job. And then there are a chunk of people who really love medicine and are totally enamored by every aspect of patient care. And the minute that they begin to learn any part of it, there's nothing else in their life for them. There's nowhere else they can go, and they will be here forever. And that's really the bulk of it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because you do describe some people, and I thought, gee, this almost sounds like the service sector, you know? I mean, jobs that don't require a college education, and don't pay that well and sure don't pay what the job is worth. And then, you know, you had that one place where you were working where they were actually drinking on the job, these EMTs, and smoking, and you know, they weren't specimens of good health themselves. And you questioned their sort of commitment to the job, and that means the people that they're being called out on. And I thought, holy cow, I never thought, who are those people driving those trucks? I see them as heroes. I suppose much of the time they are, but it's an interesting breed of people there.
Yeah, you know, it's like any segment of society. You are going to have people who are great at their job and people who aren't. And there are different types of EMS companies. You know, there are the 911 providers, and then there are ones who just take people to appointments. And the lower on that ladder you go, you know, the worse type of employee you're going to get. And I started out at, you know, among the worst type of places, and it was a shock to see some of the people there. But the vast majority of the people that I worked with are really dedicated, and will spend their entire lives doing that call, even though they're making less than they could make at Starbucks. It's just remarkable when you think about how difficult that job is.
Isn't that amazing? These special skills, you know, you need a certain sort of person, and then they've got to go get the training, and then they've got to be willing to do it, and we're not paying them much at all. I'm out of time. The book is 1,000 Naked Strangers. Kevin Hazard, you're no longer in the business, are you?
I'm not. I got out in 2013.
And was that because of a lawsuit?
No, although, like many people, I was involved in a lawsuit, but I got out because my son was sick, and he was constantly having to be taken out of daycare, and someone needed to stay home with him. And so my wife made a whole lot more money than I did, so I quit so I could stay home and keep him healthy.
Kevin Hazard's book is really just a page-turner. I'll be watching the movie, Kevin, and let's talk again down the road. I sure appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob Kessler. This is John Williams, and this is our Vibe Score segment, which we always start out with a song. You know, it's from Vibe Score. That's one word. It's an app that you can download for free at the iTunes Store, at the App Store. That's Vibe Score, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. Subscribe to Vibe Score. It's free, and we'll feed you a bunch of news stories about things you say you're interested in. Fashion, the Chicago scene, food and drink, sports, movies, TV. We'll give you the information you want, and then we ask you to score a question about that category. For instance, well, let's see, Griffin, was that in music or movies, what we just heard?
Music.
Music, and that was Sam Smith singing the theme from the James Bond movie, right?
The Spectre theme, Writings on the Wall, which won Best Song at the Oscars a week ago.
You got a problem with that?
Sure do.
Me too.
Hey, Decker. Why is everybody hating? I thought that performance was pretty good. No?
This is not a good song, especially considering all the other songs it was up against.
It was not a bad performance, I guess, but we were just talking about the song, and I don't like that song at all. I don't think it's good. But
it was scale boring. On a scale of 1 to 100, you get to rate it. I gave it an 85. Griff, where are you on that one?
I was down. Now I'm thinking there's no reason to be this harsh, but I did go about 14.
I think I did too, because I just didn't like the song that much.
Yeah, it's like, get a grip. A song shouldn't be a 14 in your world.
Hey, why not?
It was the rating of the song. It's not saying it's changed your life for the worse.
Yeah,
it's just you don't like the song.
Let me say one thing that happened too, and this happened at the Oscars, was Lady Gaga gave that really powerful performance somewhere right before they gave out the award. And then it felt kind of awkward for anything else to get it because it was so, you were like in that moment. And then to this other song that I kind of felt negatively about, or at least I don't care about at all. So that also had me switching a little bit.
Well, the Gaga performance, boy, this sounds like a year ago, but it was just last, Sunday night. I thought Gaga was fantastic. Didn't you think that she just killed it at the Oscars? It was sort of like her Super Bowl performance. She upstaged the game. I thought she was the best thing.
So much emotion. I think that's what made it so powerful, because that song is something that hit close to her. And to her, she just really felt the song. And you could tell that through her performance.
And then they had those people walk out on stage with her and then out the door. That was really amazing. One of the questions we asked on Vibe Score was, in the TV group Chris Rock and the Oscars, 1 to 100, how'd they do? I gave it a 60. It's trending at a 68 right now. Rock was okay, but the show, I think, stayed on that theme too long. What did you give it, Kristen? 1 to 100, the Oscars.
I gave it an 89.
How
I liked
you,
Chris Rock. I thought he did a great job.
He did good. He did fine.
I thought they handled the issue appropriately. I mean, maybe at first I thought it could have been a little overkill, but then I thought, no. Like, this is a serious issue, and I thought it was appropriate to poke fun at it as much as they did. And it got people talking.
It did that. Where were you on that one, Griff?
I went 75, and I'm kind of grading on a curve there, I think, because the Oscars are impossible to host well. I don't understand why they've never figured it out, but it's always going to be too long and boring in parts and kind of a drag here and there. So, and that definitely happened last week, too. But I thought his monologue, it was prickly, and it took a lot of different sides on the issue and had a lot to say. And I just thought that was so good that, I went 75.
Jada Pinkett Smith, the stuff about her and Will, I thought was hilarious. I think the funniest thing at the Oscars was Louis C.K. when he was handing out the award for Best Documentary Short. He said, these are the people that are going to take this thing home in a Honda Civic. It was very, very funny stuff. In the group Chicago, here's a couple of interesting ones. Ravinia, they just released their schedule. What do you make of the whole Ravinia thing? I never like Ravinia. I always love their schedule. I'm always excited to see the acts. And then I always realize, I can't get there. You cannot get in and out of that place in the same, 36-hour period. So I gave the whole Ravinia thing a bad score. You know, and maybe that's because I spent so much time living in LaGrange. Maybe if I lived where Steve Bertrand does, north side, it would have been easier for me to give it a good score. But I can't. Sorry, Ravinia, you got to fix that. You got to, have a super highway from my door to yours or something. But the parking and everything is just a mess over there.
I scored it a 50 because I've never been there, but I've never been there not because I didn't like any shows. I love most of the lineup, but because I've heard people like you say those things, and I thought, I don't want to deal with that headache, so I've never experienced Ravinia.
Yeah, maybe take the train, although even that gets crowded.
No, I heard that was super crowded, too.
I did see a couple comments on the app similar, but, it's up at a 70, so maybe you should give it a try.
Also, the new Helmut Jahn building. It's going to be this skyscraper on 1000 South Michigan, which I'm not exactly sure where that puts that. I thought it was closer to Millennium Park, but there's a picture of it. There's a couple stories about it, or a story about it, and the design. That's getting a 76 right now. You know who's also getting a 76 is my boy John Kasich, the adult in the room at the debate Thursday night. Kasich's getting a 76. That's actually pretty high for any of the candidates. So congrats to you, John. I gave him a higher number than that. I'm digging his thing, man. I love his brown suit demeanor over there in the corner. But 76 is about as high as it gets. Are you feeling the love for John Kasich, Griffin?
Yeah. Yeah, I went high with that, too.
That does not sound like love for John Kasich.
No, it is. It is. I mean, compared to the other three, I would say definitely. Definitely feeling
the
love.
Higher than the others get, yeah. In fact,
I gave him a 95.
No kidding. Look at that.
But only due to his actions, and his demeanor during all of this,
Oh, I see. Maybe not his position on policies. Maybe you don't agree
really
with him.
I don't really know any of that. I just look at him and I'm like, well, at least, like he said, at least he acts like a mature adult.
Well, I think I know how you feel on some issues. Say Planned Parenthood, say climate change, and, I could pick another one, gay rights. You and he are in different positions, Kristen.
I'm voting Democrat, so, but I'm just saying,
as a Democrat, at that Republican, yes, you could give him a good score.
Yes.
Well, we asked you to turn the little scoring wheel to the left or the right, and if you turned it all the way to the right, it would be Trump, and if you turned it all the way to the left, it would be Hillary. Right now, that is sitting at a 24, meaning people are favoring Hillary. They're not loving either of them. but they sure like Hillary better than they do Donald Trump. And that, by the way, is reflective in the national polls as well. Let me give you guys a different one. Speaking of politics, Megyn Kelly's
hair. John, I just wanted to say something about that. Like, if someone is using Vibe and they don't necessarily want their position to be known, like, on who they're voting for, it is nice that you can vote anonymously.
I do that sometimes. Do you?
No, because I don't care. But
you don't care?
I was just thinking, like, I just remember my dad being like, don't tell people who you're voting for. That's rude. So you can still play along if you don't want your name associated with it.
I think that's a nice feature. Yeah, there's a little button on the bottom. It says anonymous. When you tap that, your score is added into the total, but we don't know who did it. So the total will go from like 20 people who have vibed on this to now 21, but you'll only see 20 scores. One of them is, well, you'll see all the scores, but you won't see who put it in there. It's anonymous.
You maybe should have used that when you were scoring the Sam Smith song.
Okay, let's do the most important one. The perfect one for Vibe Score this week was Megyn Kelly's hair. It's visual. It's a gut reaction. You know, it's visceral. I think she looks great. And I think the more much of America comes to hear her, the more they like her. So I gave her hair a 95. Deck, you're kind of the hair queen at WGN. What do you think of Megyn Kelly's shorter blonde hairdo?
Oh, yeah, she can definitely pull it off. She looks great. Yeah. She's got great, beautiful facial features, so she can pull off any haircut.
All of the women on Fox are just a little too glammed up for me to really take them seriously. Like, they do the 5 at 5. They've got some beautiful men and women sitting around talking politics, and I always watch it with the volume down. But the women are only because I'm on the air at the time.
Oh, okay.
So I can't have the volume up. But I watch it, so it's a really weird way. I see them, and I have feelings about them, but I've never heard their voices. But they're just, the women are so voluptuous and beautiful and made up that it's hard for me to take them seriously.
And I like Candy Crowley. You know, she's the opposite of that.
Oh, yeah, really? Well, I think Megyn Kelly's a little bit of each. I do take her seriously, and I love the look. So good scores for her hairdo. The movie Spotlight is getting an 85, as it should, right, Griff? What did you say, Griffin, the best movie was you saw this year?
Last year, 2015, would be Spotlight. Yeah, that was my favorite. And usually it doesn't line up that wins Best Picture, and it was kind of a surprise to see Spotlight take it home. And I was happy. I think it's an amazing, amazing movie.
In the Chicago sports category, we asked, what do you think, 1 to 100, 100 is they're going to win it all. What are the Bulls' playoff chances? Okay, Deckard, you haven't looked, so just guess. What do you think Vibe Score is saying for the Bulls' playoff chances, 1 to 100?
I'd say a 10.
It's 38. So there's still some hope alive, but that's not a good number, Bulls fans. And frankly, they deserve that, I would say. One other one here. Lou Manfredini every week does a new to Lou segment on his Saturday show. And we feature that item that's new to Lou on Vibe Score. So if you follow Lou Manfredini on Vibe Score, you'll be able to see what that item is. There's a link to the site. You can actually purchase it. There's a video usually attached, and you get to say, hey, I think this is something that's clever and good or not. This week, it's something called phone soap. Phone soap. It's an ultraviolet case that you put your phone in, and then the ultraviolet light inside the case sanitizes your phone. Your cell phone has 18 times more bacteria than you will find on the doorknob of a public restroom. That's your cell phone that you're putting up to your mouth and face and ear. But if you put it in this thing, it kills the bacteria there. So it's a sanitizing case. It also recharges your phone. It's called phone soap. And it's getting good scores right now. It's in the 90s.
I appreciate what they're doing, but why not just run it through the dishwasher?
All right, the boys from the B.
Wait, can I say I gave my first 100 and I was so excited?
I don't believe in the hundreds, Kristen. There should be no hundreds on Vibe Score.
But the John Oliver Drumpf segment got a 100 from me.
That got a lot of vibes and a very good score. In fact, Griff, I think you put that on my sheet here. What did the John Oliver segment get?
Yeah, it's
75.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. I'm surprised, Decker. I actually thought it was doing better than that. If you want to see Trump broken down, not just made fun of, but actually dissected policy point by policy point, Oliver did it on Sunday night. And that's on Vibe Score, too. You can watch the whole segment there. Thanks, Kristen Decker, for popping in with us. Griffin's our producer.
Me.
We'll say hi to the boys from The Beat next on WGN. We asked the boys from The Beat to come by a little early on Saturdays and preview for us their show. Hi, fellas.
Hey, John.
Good afternoon, John.
Kevin Powell and Mark Carmen are getting ready to roll.
John, I would agree that you look fantastic since you started using Chamonix. I just want to throw that out there.
Those crow's feet are gone, aren't they?
They are. Looking great.
And the bags, the puffiness, wouldn't you say my eyes look a little leaner and cleaner?
Absolutely. All gone. No more bags. Yeah.
John, when's the last time you saw me, Kevin? Literally. When's the last time you looked me in the face?
I think it was maybe Christmas time. Weren't your
back Christmas?
Christmas time?
I think it was Christmas.
Oh,
you should see
months.
Me now. I yeah. look 14 now. I'll walk in and
it works wonders.
Recognize. What were you about to say, Mark Carmen?
I was just going to say, John, that I've known you since 2007, and to me, you have not aged a day. I just see glory from day one till day now.
Oh,
just
man.
Know that, pal.
We have to end this. So on the promo, you guys said you're going to be talking baseball. Did I hear that correctly?
We have a bunch of baseball, but pretty interesting day with down in Champaign, firing the old football coach, Bill Cubitt, before he was ever actually the football coach, even though he was.
Wait a minute. What happened there?
Well, you got a new AD, and you got they had one meeting together, and then Josh Whitman went into Bill Cubitt's office and said, "Hey, buddy, you're fired, along with the five assistants that you just brought over here as well, and their families will have to figure out what they're doing too." So,
really,
yeah, Illinois.
What do you think happened? Was there like a dust up, or did everybody see that coming?
Well, Bill Cubitt was given a 2-year contract last year after stepping in as the interim head coach, and actually did a pretty decent job last season. They went 5-7, which was, I think, better than what most people projected them going. Reports we're seeing on social media and the buzz is that a lot of trustees and donors and higher-ups at the school, not a fan of his. And Josh Whitman, the new athletic director, was feeling some heat. This is his first day on the job, by the way, his first official day on the
really?
Job. And he
wow.
goes ahead and fires the head football coach. So more turmoil down in Champaign.
Well, does the coach still get paid?
Oh, yeah. He got a nice little $950,000 payday. So he'll be okay for a while. That should hold him over.
It's a little bit less than Kevin and I are going to get paid for today's show.
Then that whole business of the families having to relocate or figure out what they're going to do.
Well, and his son was
$950,000.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
Yeah, his son was an assistant on the team as well, and he was sent packing. The rest of the assistant coaches will have a chance to at least interview with whoever is hired to keep their jobs.
Do you want to throw your hat in the ring, John?
No, you know what we're following in Minnesota is that Rich Pitino story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Rick Pitino's son, Rich, who is, of course, the Gopher men's basketball coach. They've been terrible this year, and they weren't any good last year. These are his players, and three of them got kicked off the team for some sort of sex tape that was shared on social media. And this is a guy who last year got a $400,000 bonus. I mean, I just don't understand how these schools throw money around sometimes. It's amazing.
It's pretty incredible. If you look at some of the highest paid public employees in every state, it's almost always a head football coach or basketball coach or athletic director.
Yeah, and I can understand it if, I don't know, you've had a long tenure and you've won a lot and the program is good and you bring a lot of students to the school, that's for sure. But, at least earn it, at least have a great track record before they start throwing that kind of coin around.
That guy, too, in Pitino has some big-time recruits coming in the next year. I mean, Minnesota's like top 10 recruiting class. So
Amir Coffey is one of them, I think. Is that the kid's name? Although now the parents of some of these kids, I know just a teeny bit about this, but the parents of some of the kids who have committed to the school, and I think if you sign a letter of intent, that's kind of binding, isn't it? I don't know if it's easy to get out of that or not, but they're like, oh, geez, maybe we shouldn't send our kid to that school, kind of a tough call for those families.
If they want to get out, they can get out.
That's what I was thinking. You're not. It's not like an employment contract.
No.
So baseball tonight or today, also U of I football as well.
Yeah.
Well, listen, fellas, have a really good show. I'll pause here and we'll let you guys get to it on time. How does that sound?
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
That's Kevin Powell, Mark Carmen. I'm John Williams. We'll wrap it up in a minute on WGN. Bob Kessler's got the news here in a second. Just give me that much time to say that you can subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's that roundtable of conversation about news and politics featuring Steve Bertrand and some of our friends from the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie. Mark Baser from The Interview Show was also one of our guests this week, and that is called The Mincing Rascals. You can subscribe to that podcast on the iTunes Store. You can also hear it at WGNplus.com. And at those same places, you can also catch my weekly conversations with Thomas Jefferson. Yeah, I talk to dead presidents, you know, and the conversation this week with in my conversation this week with Thomas Jefferson, he notes that if instead of 2016, the Republican debate this week had happened, if the Republican debate this week had happened 200 years ago, it would have resulted in a duel. And his thought about that and point is funny and also well played. So I hope you can catch all of that as well. Let's catch you up on the news. Oh, by the way, thank you to Krista Flores, our engineer, Griffin Filipich, our producer, and Bob Kessler has the news on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.